This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sorry if this is a personal question, but how you doing? Yeah, you. How you doing? The economy really wants to know. Consumer confidence on the broadcast today. Also, electric cars and rich basketball players. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 29th of June today, and we know, if we look at the numbers, that we are enjoying some moderate economic growth. Companies are building up production. They're investing in new equipment. There is some hiring going on. You take away the absolutes, though, the numbers, and the economy just doesn't feel that good. Consumer confidence took a tumble this month after 3 months when people seemed to be feeling better. As we have said, I don't know how many times, consumer spending is a real key economic measure. How confident should we be in consumer confidence, though? Here's Jeff Horwich.
The Consumer Confidence Index, this number that comes out at the end of each month, is a survey. 5,000 random people asked how they feel about the economy. We all snap to attention, especially when it's bad news. And with good reason, says Lynn Franco. She directs the survey for the Conference Board.
Consumer confidence gives us a very good read on the health of the U.S. economy, and consumers have been excellent predictors of recessions.
The logic is simple. Franco says apprehensive consumers don't spend money. And to measure that level of apprehension, the survey relies heavily on one component, how worried consumers are about the job market.
Until the pace of growth, job growth really picks up, it's probably going to be a very bumpy road for confidence.
How worried should we be? Take it easy, says Lynn Reeser, president of the National Association for Business Economics.
We do look at the consumer confidence indices, but actually it is more important to see what consumers actually do as opposed to what they say.
Reeser says actual retail sales picked up in the early part of the year. Business spending still points to a modest recovery. Consumer confidence numbers also give the media something to talk about, and that creates a kind of feedback loop. Professor David Fan of the University of Minnesota looked at what was actually informing people who answered consumer confidence surveys.
They are relying more on the press news media coverage in general than they are about their own personal experiences.
So, are we helping or hurting? Well, let's see. 1 month ago, consumer confidence was up for the third straight month. Did we mention that on this show? No. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
It was big news a couple of months ago when Google got a little testy with the Chinese. The search company was annoyed about some fairly sophisticated hacks on its database that it said came from China. So it started automatically redirecting its Chinese users to its less restricted, that is, less censored site in Hong Kong. Today, conveniently just 1 day before Google's license to do business on the mainland was set to expire, the company backed down a little bit. It'll offer those Chinese users a link to the Hong Kong site instead of the automatic redirection. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has more.
It's a lesson that's as old as doing business in China, how to save face.
You don't really gain very much by publicly airing your dirty laundry with the Chinese government.
And now it's Google's turn to learn that lesson. Adam Siegel is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations who's an expert on China's internet policies. He says Google's last-minute, very public offer to China after months of an equally public squabble with the government suggests the company has been trying to bargain with the Chinese behind closed doors, but has now run out of options.
I suspect that we're going to have some final resolution from the Chinese government, and then Google is going to have to decide how it manages its other businesses in China.
In other words, without a website in mainland China, can Google expect a profit from China's lucrative mobile phone market? That's what Google's shareholders may be wondering. Tech industry analyst Laura DiDio says the threat of losing China probably won't have an impact on the company's stock price or dividends because Google is so strong in other global markets.
You're going to have a lot of shareholders, particularly here in North America and Western Europe, who might actually cheer Google on if they decide to stick and hold fast to their principles.
But what's more important for Google, ensuring a free flow of information or reaching as many people as possible? Google claims it organizes the world's information. It may organize it, but 20% of the world's population may soon stop using Google to consume it. I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
The financial overhaul bill is officially known as the Dodd-Frank Act. That's after the two members of Congress who pushed it through a conference committee last week after an epic round of negotiations. I would offer a new name, though, the Never-Ending Bill. Both the House and Senate were supposed to vote on a final bill this week. And then Monday, Democrat Robert Byrd died. And today, Republican Scott Brown said he has changed his mind about voting yes. He doesn't like a $19 billion bank tax that's supposed to pay for the bill, which means the thing doesn't have the 60 votes it needs to get past a Senate filibuster, which means, well, here's Brett Neely from Washington.
The bank tax was a middle-of-the-night solution so that the financial overhaul bill wouldn't add to the budget deficit. But, says Karen Petru of Federal Financial Analytics,
that undermined a very fragile compromise that the Senate crafted. So now they've got to figure out a way to make this budget neutral without the new tax.
Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown said he couldn't support the tax because consumers, not banks, would end up paying for it. Raj Date is with the Cambridge Winter Center on Financial Institutions Policy. He says that Brown's concerns about the tax are misplaced.
The size of the tax is so small that consumers wouldn't even notice the difference.
Regardless, House and Senate negotiators now have to scramble for new sources of funding. One idea would be to use leftover money from the TARP Bank Bailout Fund to pay for the financial overhaul bill. Another idea includes raising the fees the FDIC charges banks for deposit insurance. That's to satisfy budget rules and the Congressional Budget Office, says Petru.
I mean, this is a scoring game, not a reality game.
She says the congressional leadership and the White House want the bill done and will do what they have to do to finish it.
I think this is a last-minute hiccup, not a sigh of exhaustion that dooms the legislation.
If negotiators come up with a deal, the House could hold its final vote tomorrow. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
The stock market today was, well, I just can't repeat some of the words I heard about it today. We will have the details minus the bad words when we do the number. California State Legislature adjourned yesterday for a July recess. Not that big a deal. Everybody needs some time off. Except that tomorrow is the end of the California fiscal year, and there is no new state budget in sight in Sacramento. Tomorrow, in fact, is the deadline for most states to come up with new spending plans. They're doing all they can to get themselves into the black because most state constitutions require a balanced budget. But different states have different financial problems and so different solutions to their budget gaps. From WBEZ in Chicago, Tony Arnold begins our coverage.
Illinois' budget outlook is so weak, the state has a budget hole of $13 billion.
The state of Illinois is sinking faster than even California.
Lawrence Massal heads the Civic Federation, a fiscal watchdog group in Chicago. He says the state's budget problems can't be blamed on one governor, not even Rod Blagojevich. Instead, he says it's been 30 years in the making, and pension benefits for state employees have been a big reason for the budget mess.
We ignored the fact that you cannot spend more than you take in. We ignored the fact that you cannot have unrealistic pension benefits, especially if you're not going to fund them.
The state House of Representatives passed a plan to borrow almost $4 billion for pensions, but the votes weren't there in the Senate, and senators ended the session without bringing it up. Missal says that's going to be devastating down the road, and Illinois' bond ratings have dropped significantly. Meantime, the state's behind on paying its bills, leaving schools and social service agencies on their own. Even the powerful Speaker of the House, Michael Madigan, makes no bones about the situation.
Will there be people who say, well, the budget is not balanced? That's correct, because we're in a depression.
If the budget isn't balanced, technically it's illegal. But there's no plan for legislators to return to the state capitol anytime soon. In Chicago, I'm Tony Arnold from Marketplace.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Pennsylvania. For the second year in a row, education spending is dominating budget negotiations here. Democratic Governor Ed Rendell is in the final months of his final term, and he says a key part of his legacy will be the annual boost to the subsidy Pennsylvania provides local school districts. Rendell's insistence on a substantial increase last year held up the budget for 3.5 months. This year, Pennsylvania faces a $1.2 billion revenue gap, but Rendell wants another education spending increase of $354 million.
Why in God's name would we stop? We're doing something really good for the future of our children and the future of our state.
But the top state Senate Republican, Majority Leader Dominic Pileggi, argues the boost Rendell wants is irresponsible and unsustainable, especially if a federal subsidy known as FMAP does not come through.
What happens when we don't get the $850 million FMAP subsidy? What's the first thing that should go or must go?
It looks like Governor Rendell will get his education increase, but in the face of a billion-dollar deficit, nearly every other state program will see its funding reduced. In Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, I'm Scott Detrow for Marketplace.
I'm Janet Babin in North Carolina. That federal subsidy Pennsylvania's waiting for? Well, 29 other states need it, too. It has to do with Medicaid funding, the health care program for the poor. And without that money, those states have a gaping hole in their budgets. North Carolina has a $500 million shortfall. Senator Linda Garrew says lawmakers have been left with unappealing options, like cutting services or even cutting doctors' Medicaid reimbursements.
I had a number of doctors in my office the other day, and they were saying, you know, you can't cut us here, you can't cut us there.
But Garrew says those doctors should talk to Congress. She says they're the ones that cut Medicaid funding, not her. Last year, states received extra federal money for the program as part of the economic stimulus package, and they were counting on Congress to extend that aid. But the measure died in the Senate. North Carolina's Governor Beverly Perdue says just as the feds pulled back, her Medicaid rolls have exploded.
We have never seen Medicaid at this kind of magnitude.
And some say that's Medicaid's key flaw. When more people need it, the tax revenues that help pay for it decline. Nick Johnson's with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
The Medicaid program is not well designed to respond to recessions.
Long term, Johnson says Medicaid needs a new funding formula. Meantime, states like North Carolina hope Congress comes through with that funding. But Governor Perdue doesn't think it will come in time, hence the mad dash in many states to increase taxes or slash services. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Love it or hate it, the Federal Reserve has an amazing amount of power. We all know it has a huge hand in where interest rates go, and we know it's been especially active in the economy the past couple of years. But how it does what it does? That, most people are less clear on. Thankfully, our commentator Justin Fox has a suggestion as we continue our summer book series.
As a senior in college, I wasn't all that interested in economics. But I did think I wanted to become a journalist. So when I heard that Bill Greider was coming to campus to teach a class called Writing About the Economy, I signed up. Greider was the national editor of Rolling Stone, and already something of a legend among journalists. A class with him might be fun, I thought. It was fun, in a weird sort of way. Greider was nearing the end of an all-consuming 5-year book project. So we talked about his struggles. We read books that he'd used in his research. We went over his draft chapters. The book came out not long after I graduated in 1987. It was called Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country. I was young and poor, so I waited for the paperback. Then I was daunted by the length, almost 800 pages. It wasn't until 1995 that I finished it, on my honeymoon. But what a book it was, and still is. It's a model of what contemporary history should be, told with great narrative verve and a strong point of view, but also fair and comprehensive. Even now, it remains by far the best popular explanation of how the Federal Reserve evolved and what it does. It's neither conspiracy tract nor Fed apologia, just a clear-eyed, skeptical look at a hugely important institution. It's exactly the kind of book, in fact, that ought to inform the current debate over the Fed and its powers. I asked Grider the other day if he had any plans to update it. Too old, he said. Maybe you should. Uh-uh.
Justin Fox is the editorial director of the Harvard Business Review. Thanks for your thoughts yesterday about our summer reading list. Keep on adding to it, if you would, titles and reviews if you've got a minute. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Coming up, Tesla takes it public.
It's very speculative. It's got lots of glamour, excitement, you know, sexy names, sexy ideas.
Sadly, first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the Dow Industrials plummeted 268 points today, 2.67%, finished at 9,870. The NASDAQ down 85 points, 3.8%, 2135 at the bell. The S&P 500 fell 33 points. That is 3.1%, ended the day at 1,041. Concerns about slower economic activity in China and continued fears of, yes, the European debt crisis had traders jumping out of stocks today. Citigroup fell nearly 7%. Wells Fargo and Morgan Stanley erased more than 4%. J.P. Morgan Chase cashed out 3.8% today. You name a blue chip and it likely lost big. Alcoa and Boeing both flew down more than 6%. Caterpillar unloaded 5.5%. General Electric flicked down 3.5% today. Bonds gained. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.95%. Keep an eye on that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by MassMutual, a mutual life insurance company owned by its members and policyholders. Learn more at massmutual.com/mutuality. And by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com/market. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission examines the role of derivatives. A House committee looks at how small businesses will be impacted by BP's $20 billion claims fund. And the National Gallery in London showcases counterfeit paintings that the museum accidentally purchased. I'm Cormac O'Connor.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The NBA championships have come and gone, but there is arguably a bigger day in store for basketball fans this week. July the 1st, Thursday, is when free agents can start contract negotiations with other teams. And there is no free agent in the league bigger than LeBron James. He made around $18 million this year, but millions more in ticket revenue and merchandising deals will turn on whether James stays with his hometown club, the Cleveland Cavaliers, or if he goes elsewhere. The guy is just that valuable. That very value, though, can turn out to be a problem for whichever team does get him. Ira Boudway makes that point in a piece for Bloomberg Business Week. Ira, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
How does the best basketball player in a generation, LeBron James, get to be a problem for a team?
He becomes a problem because the way the NBA salary cap works, owners just can't pay him what he's worth to a franchise. They can only pay him, at this point in his career, 30% of the team salary cap, which is projected to be about $56 million, and that's far below what he's worth to a franchise. And so they have to find other ways to make him, in Cleveland's case, want to stay, or in the case of his other suitors, want to go.
It's a case of disproportionate value, right? If he gets 30%
right.
of the whole payroll, it sort of doesn't work that way.
Right. I mean, players like Anderson Varejao, who's on the team, who's a pretty good player, makes 40% of what LeBron does, and there's just no math that makes him 40% as valuable to the team.
Is there something else that the rest of us can understand? Is there like a real-life example where you can say, you know what, here's another instance or profession where you have these guys who are disproportionately valuable?
One of the big ones that came up in reporting the piece is really exceptional trial lawyers, where they frequently exist in these big corporate firms where the pay structure is based almost entirely on seniority and hours billed.
It's interesting you said lawyers. I was going to say Hollywood, right? All those big movie stars who get, you know, $20 million a picture?
Yeah, they are similar to basketball players because they really have a limited number of places they can go to get their paycheck. For big-time Hollywood stars, it's the six big studios. And so the stars, you know, kind of have to take what the studios are giving, but where they get some leverage is when they get identified or attached to a hit franchise. And the example that we give in the piece is Tobey Maguire. He made $4 million for the first Spider-Man movie. He had a contract for three, but he just went back to the studio and said, you know, I want to renegotiate. And he got $17 million for the second one and $15 million plus a big cut of the back end for the third one.
Which is a pretty nice payday for running around in a spider suit.
Exactly.
Just to get it back to LeBron James and basketball, how does a team, when it has this handicap, has these restrictions on it, how do they get somebody to sign?
The biggest thing, especially in the case of LeBron James, is making the case that this is the place where he can go to win. But you also have to pay attention to a lot of the peripherals, that he can be comfortable there, that he will get along with the coach, that they will take care of him, and that they are completely dedicated to his happiness.
Look at it for me from the owner's perspective. The owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers finds himself on the horns of a dilemma, right? How much does he invest in this guy who is so disproportionately valuable? He can't actually come out and say, I'll do what it takes to sign him, but nor can he say, oh, I'm done with LeBron.
Yeah, he has to kind of walk a tightrope because he has to pretend that the Cavs are not ruined if LeBron James leaves, to the tune of, they say, at least $20 million a year. That's what he's worth in just sort of the revenue up front. They are kind of in a real bind if he leaves, but he has to project strength. He has to say, you know, we think this is the best place for him to play, but if he decides to go elsewhere, we think we can succeed anyway.
This is a little bit metaphysical, but it's almost like he or the star player in question winds up owning the owner, if you will.
Yes. I mean, he has a bigger say in the ultimate value and fate of the franchise than really any of the owners do. And these are people who have put up hundreds of millions of dollars to own these teams.
Ira Boudway at Bloomberg Business Week talking about the dilemma of disproportionate value. Ira, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Our last story this afternoon comes with a bit of history attached to it. Today, for the first time in 54 years, an American car company went public, offered its shares for sale to investors. The electric car maker Tesla started trading today under the ticker symbol TSLA. Did pretty well, too. On a day when the major indices took a drubbing, Tesla shares gained more than 40% from their offering price. So, obviously, there was a pretty good amount of interest in both the company and the IPO itself. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
One of the ways Tesla butters up reporters and investors is by putting them behind the wheel of one of their $100,000 electric roadsters.
This is our bright orange Roadster Sport. This car goes 0 to 60 in 3.7 seconds.
Kobe Brooklyn, a Tesla PR exec, met me in the company's Palo Alto parking lot. The car is ridiculously small.
I almost fell.
Getting into it is like slipping into an electric body rocket.
All right, so now we're going to test the 0 to 60. Oh, my God!
Tesla's investors could be in for a wild ride, too. Silicon Valley hasn't seen many IPOs like this one for more than a decade.
They had a DeLorean in the Back to the Future movies. If they make another Back to the Future movie, they should use a Tesla, because this is such a 1999 IPO.
Brett Arends is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal who studied the IPO.
It's very speculative. It's got lots of glamour, excitement, you know, sexy names, sexy ideas.
But like the great high-tech IPOs of the past, there's one thing Tesla's missing.
Absolutely. No profits. No profits to date and no profits for the foreseeable future.
So far, Tesla's sold just over 1,000 of its very expensive handmade electric sports cars, many to celebrities like George Clooney and Brad Pitt. But it's racked up losses of close to $300 million. And Elon Musk, one of Tesla's founders, has almost run out of cash. Musk made a fortune building and selling PayPal, but in the past few months he's had to borrow $7.5 million from Goldman Sachs and even more from friends just to pay his own personal expenses. Jacob Gross, an analyst at Lux Research, says starting a car company isn't like launching an internet firm from your basement.
You actually have to manufacture something, and the capital costs to do that are usually prohibitive.
Today's IPO and a big loan from the federal government will finance Tesla's plans to bring a $50,000 sedan to market within 2 years. Tesla also has deals to supply electric powertrains and batteries to Mercedes and possibly Toyota. Tesla's success on the stock market today isn't just good news for the company. Silicon Valley venture capitalists were also watching closely.
This industry needs 100-plus IPOs a year to truly be a successful entity.
Mark Heeson is president of the National Venture Capital Association. In Silicon Valley, most startups depend on venture funding. VCs look to their own investors to raise cash, and those investors need a healthy market for IPOs to get their money back. But during the financial crisis, that market for IPOs dried up. And Gross, the Lux analyst, says in the first half of 2009, only 13 companies went public.
It's been really challenging, that's for sure. But when you talk about clean tech IPOs, the market's starting to thaw a bit.
Still, any real recovery for initial public offerings looks pretty fragile. In the past few weeks, several other green tech firms have postponed selling stock. But Tesla's Elon Musk, who certainly needed the cash and pocketed more than $20 million today, decided to ignore the volatile markets and press ahead.
If one follows the day-to-day movements of the stock market, you're sort of asking to be schizophrenic. I don't think one should get too wrapped around the axle, if you will.
So maybe that means Musk isn't taking Tesla's more than $2 billion valuation this afternoon too seriously.
Just sip in front of that person.
But here in Silicon Valley, the question other entrepreneurs are asking is, has Wall Street really regained its appetite for risk? Or do the normal rules of the road simply not apply if you're driving a Tesla?
Whoa, I just blew through a stop sign.
In Palo Alto, California.
No cops.
I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
I wonder if my insurance rates will go up.
Yeah, they might.
Normally, I drive a minivan.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering total return strategies designed to match your goals. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, today you might have heard of or perhaps taken part in some of those boycotts of BP service stations since the leak in the Gulf of Mexico started more than 2 months ago. Well, those boycotts do seem to be working. The company is going to start giving stations, most of which are independently owned, some financial help, $50 to $70 million worth. Some of it's going to be straight cash. Some of it will be trades in kind, like lower credit card charges. Also, the company says the stations are going to be allowed to apply for money from that big $20 billion compensation fund as well to make themselves whole. And for now, on a Tuesday, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow bumped down 268 points, 2 2/3%. The NASDAQ fell 85 points, 3 8/10%. The S&P 500 lost 33 points, 3 1/10%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. You can tune in tomorrow to the Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, turning the harsh reality of day labor into theater.
One woman said, this is a kind of therapy for me because I'm here all day waiting at this Home Depot. And being able to laugh, if just for a second, and forget all my cares is wonderful.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.